Hello, I'm Bill Radke, and it's time for KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Thank you for tuning in. This is deadline day for 150 North American cities trying to convince Amazon to build its second headquarters there. Proposals are due today. And since these cities are lining up to get what we already have, we will now tell the winning bidder what they're in for. Mm-hmm. We are taking your phone calls right now. Tell those Amazon bidders what they need to know. Call us at 206-543-5869. That's 543-KUOW. We are, as I said, on Twitter at KUOW. We want to know what's great about having Amazon here, what's terrible, and we're going to share today's show with all those would-be HQ2 cities. So what do you want to warn them about or congratulate them for? And if you work at Amazon, or you used to work at Amazon, or you work in the tech industry, you could work for Amazon. We'd especially like your perspective. So call us right now, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. And joining me in the studio today, KUOW reporters Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph. They have a brand new podcast just launched today called Primed. Welcome to both of you.
Welcome.
Tell us about Primed.
Well, I mean, it is about what happens when Amazon comes to your city. And heck, we know, because it happened to us first. We are HQ1.
We are HQ1 and always will be.
Yes.
And so in this podcast, we are talking about what happens when Amazon comes to town. And as I just said, there's, 150 cities that think it must be fantastic when Amazon comes to town. Mm. So let's start with the fantastic. What is so great about a massive influx of people and jobs?
Well, it means a lot of opportunity. I mean, people can, it's so easy to start a cupcake restaurant here, for example.
Yes.
Or a doggy daycare.
Mm-hmm. There's a Follow lot, your dreams.
That's right. Yeah, you can do that here because of the prosperity that comes from Amazon. There's a lot of money floating around. But one of the big issues is the prosperity is not shared.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I want to get to losers on the subject of winners, because it's not always obvious that it's great to have a crush like Amazon. Are we talking, do you think that those cities are mostly looking for tax receipts and the more the better, or excitement?
You know, what I hear them saying is that they want access to the jobs. They want access to these kinds of jobs, the highly paid, you know, lords of the new church kinds of jobs that they believe are going to be part of the new economy.
Ah, so yeah, they especially want those jobs because they think that's the future.
Right, because this is not a fulfillment center we're talking about here. We're talking about, you know, the engine room of the future, which is what Amazon is, the kind of company that Amazon is turning out to be. And of course they want that. But I also hear them saying that they want, you know, they want the business tax receipts. They want the inflow into government coffers.
So now who loses? What does it, as I said, we're going to offer this show to all those bidders. Who loses in Amazon HQ2?
Well, some minorities lose because the tech sector's failure to hire at, you know, great rates African Americans and Hispanics has become our city's problem. And Seattle's grown 2% more white since 2010, despite tech's success at hiring, at least at the lower levels, lots of Asian Americans, who, according to some reports we've seen, tend to get hired a lot but promoted less frequently. So, you know, we hear problems about the tech sector being so white, but when Amazon drops, you know, 40,000 tech sector workers on this city, earning, you know, many of whom earn $100,000 a year, that problem becomes Seattle's problem. And there is so much competition for housing and, you know, road space and stuff like that. The people who can sort of afford to stay here are the people who are part of that tech economy. And that excludes a lot of minorities.
Yes, we know about rents and congestion and gentrification. Some people say homelessness increases because of Amazon. Is that something you've been reporting on in Primed? That, you know, how fair is that? Are those connections between Amazon and some social ills?
Well, it's not fair to say that Amazon causes homelessness, but it is fair to draw a correlation between the rise in rents, that we see that are associated with the tech industry and the increase in homelessness. I mean, 3/4 of people who are homeless cite, you know, rising rents as one of the primary reasons why they became homeless.
You know, it's like your Amazon helped create markets for housing and for you know, rental accommodation that have really, you know, that are the machines that have created like a, well, you know, it's like a game of mean musical chairs. The richest people will get the seats, and people will get eliminated from housing. It's not just that they'll have to drive farther out. At some point, that doesn't work. At some point, they're just eliminated. And that is homelessness.
Washington State Republican Representative J.T. Wilcox, when that lawmaker found out about Amazon wanting a headquarters too, said one of the greatest engines for economic growth known to history will be growing somewhere else. Mm. We're talking about the positives and negatives of being Amazon's second home. And we're taking your phone call. So give us a call at 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. KUOW, what is winning, what is losing about having Seattle in your town? Because 150 other cities are making a bet that it's going to be worthwhile. So we are going to share this episode and let those cities know what they are in for. 206-543-5869, and we're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm talking with reporters Carolyn Adolph and Joshua McNichols, host of the brand new podcast launching today called Primed. What does Amazon say they want in their new home?
They want a developable space. They want a place where they can put 8 million square feet of office space.
They want, they definitely want a metropolitan area of 1 million people. That's top of the list. But they seem to be open to a suburb, which is new. But I think the most fascinating line in the whole request for proposals document is the one at the very end that says, hey, you know, we might call the whole thing off. We might not even have an HQ2.
Would they do that? Call it off?
Well, who knows? But they'd still have all the information that they will have acquired by the end of business today.
Yes, and the knowledge that all these cities are willing to subsidize or give tax breaks to Amazon.
That's right.
Yeah. And who are the biggest contenders as of today, as of deadline day? Do we know?
Well, you know, everybody's got their favorites. We hear Denver talked about. We hear Washington, D.C. talked about. What others come to mind for you, Carolyn?
Well, I'll tell you, I saw some spicy CNBC reporting today that said New Jersey proposed $7 billion in credits as long as Amazon came through with the promised 50,000 jobs.
Hmm.
But you compare that to New York City, which also put in a bid and offered no special incentives because it's New York City.
We're New York.
So that's it. You know, the littler guys know they gotta try harder. And the bigger cities are like, yeah, we know you want us.
Right. What about the city of Seattle, Washington, or Tacoma, Washington, or Everett, Washington? Is that realistic?
Well, I mean, we had an Amazon executive tell a tech conference last week that we had approximately a snowball's chance in hell, and that included the entirety of the Pacific Northwest. Basically, we want to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So, however, that doesn't stop the fact that Tacoma's put in a bid, and the counties of King and Snohomish have also done this, and but not Seattle. Seattle is full for now.
Full for now, and the overflow is going where? We're going to find out soon enough. Today's deadline day for those bidding cities, and we're asking you for your advice to those would-be HQ2 homes. So we're taking your calls at 206-543-KUOW. Dave is in Kenmore. Dave, what's your advice and why?
Well, it's not so much advice as it is just be ready for the influx of other tech companies. Amazon is going to be planting its roots in your community, and there's going to be these other companies coming to the neighborhood saying, hey, there's going to be people that come to Amazon, they get laid off, or maybe they're tired of the Amazon workflow, and they want to work at another company. This is going to be rife full of people that are capable of helping these startups spin up.
So churn.
Yeah, and that brings up another important point, which is, you know, when people get tired of the sort of grind of working at Amazon, which many people do, they may leave the company and want to form startups of their own. Sometimes this happens about the time people are thinking of forming families. We don't have a lot of places for families to live. We're not growing them at the same pace as we're growing little shoeboxes where they can live. So that's where, you know, our shortage of family housing actually has an impact on our city's economic future and the ability to sort of capture some of this energy as people mature and start businesses of their own.
But that's the thing, the economic allure of creating a real vibrant tech hub, which, you know, as Dave says, with so many other companies coming into the center in order to be near Amazon and to use that workforce and create that flow that tech workers love, where they can keep walking, they can keep finding a new job until they find the right fit for them. That is exactly the kind of thing that, you know, cities would give eye teeth for. Calgary says it would, fight a bear for. I mean, It's just huge.
Dave and Kenmore, you're a startup guy. Is that right? What do you do?
Yes, sir. I help my friends find other jobs and startups. So I got this little startup that I started years ago. And it's this thing where you can have a group of people who can solve one problem really well. So companies pitch me their problems, and I find a group of people that can solve that problem, and it works out great. I'm not a recruiter. I'm just helping my friends get their jobs and move along, and they then spin up their companies, and now they've had good traffic, they've had good experience, and we all benefit from this. It's kind of a partnership with my friends.
So finally, Dave, it sounds like what you want to say right now to those bidding cities, we're going to share this episode for them. You want to tell them, go for it?
Oh, heck yeah. Well, I would say Amazon should really be looking at making their own city out someplace else and making an environment which is ideal for them. But if they're going to be finding another city, these cities should be ready and hoping for this big boom of other businesses coming towards them.
Okay, get ready. Dave and Kenmore, thanks for that call. So there's an idea. Amazon could just create its own city.
Boom.
But, you know, if you have to go to Toronto or whatever. we're taking your calls. We're with Carolyn Adolf and Joshua McNichols, KUOW reporters and hosts of the new podcast called Primed, which launches today. And we have Grant in Belltown. Grant, other cities are going to hear this. 150 cities are bidding. What do you want to tell those cities about the experience of Amazon HQ?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon. I would say that if you live in one of those cities and you're looking at purchasing a home, you better do it before Amazon comes in, because the price increase of real estate has gotten so out of hand that middle-class people can't even purchase a house in Seattle right now.
So you would recommend the bidding cities engage in insider trading and start buying up real estate on that knowledge?
Well, I think it's more of, you know, when I have a coworker, for example, that loves Seattle, lives in Seattle right now, and he's buying a house in Tacoma because he can't afford to buy a place here. I think that's the thing that hurts the most. It's really important for us to be able to have upper, middle, and lower class people in Seattle have the ability to purchase a home.
Yeah, and owning a home is one very important way to get, you know, some of that prosperity. But how do you do that? Because it kind of reminds me of when the railroads were deciding where to put their Western terminus, you know, and people lost their shirts betting on the wrong horse, you know, because it ended up going somewhere else. And the moment Amazon announces its headquarters location, it'll be too late, right?
Yeah, but by the same token, I mean, home is security. And what's happened to so many people here is this endless stream of requests from landlords for more money. And that has forced all of these people to keep moving. And it has filled some of them with the great desire to just to have the security of knowing that you live where you live. And that whole thing has broken down for so many people because that home is not accessible. One of the things I've definitely heard city politicians say is, hey, whoever you are, city, you should start building not just housing right away, you should build affordable housing right away.
And better at least have transit lines from the place you work to the place you can afford to live.
Oh,
so finally, Grant in Belltown, overall, would you advise one of these bidding cities, you know what, pull out of the bid, you don't want a piece of this, or would you say, know what you're getting in for and then go for it?
I think it would be know what you're getting into and go for it. I don't think that the growth that Seattle has had can be sustainable, and some of those things are going to hurt a lot of the middle class on down people.
Grant, thanks for calling. We're taking your calls at 206-543-KUOW, 543-5869, because today is deadline day for cities that think that they want to be the home of Amazon's second headquarters. They want what we have, but do they know what we have? Do they know about the winners and losers? We are advising other cities right now at 543-KUOW, letting those other cities know what they're in for. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. It's KUOW's The Record. Today is deadline day when 150 North American cities needed to have their bid in to try to convince Amazon to build its second headquarters there. So, since these cities want what we have, we're telling the winning bidder what they're in for. The pluses and the minuses of having Amazon here. What should they know? Eyes wide open. So give us a call at 206-543-5869. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. 543-KUOW. And Tris in Bothell has some advice for those bidders. Hello, Tris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. What do you want to say to an HQ2 bidding city?
Well, if I was a city that received the new headquarters, what I would do is I would identify new capacity needs, whether it's road lanes, whether it's buildings, whether it's parks and open space. I would identify those new capacity needs, I would plan for them, cost them out, and charge impact fees to all new development that comes into the city to accommodate that new growth. And then you're not just scapegoating one company for the perceived impacts of growth. And I think, I'm not sure about this, but I don't think Seattle charges impact fees. And had they charged impact fees for all the new growth that's coming in there, not just looking at Amazon, but all the accompanying growth, the city in that situation would have the ability to plan for growth and have that new development pay for growth.
Great idea. I want to mention that you mentioned the capacity needs. The weaknesses of every city will come to define that city when growth is accelerated by Amazon, be it, lack of transportation infrastructure, lack of housing. These are the things that sort of define Seattle's problems today. There are good things that define Seattle, too. But there is one critique of impact fees, especially when applied to housing, is that basically you're taxing something that the city also desperately needs. So I guess there's that concern, too. You don't want to slow down production of housing.
Yeah, in fact, what we hear mostly about is other cities not talking about impact fees, but talking about how can we make a maybe even a more attractive city than Seattle. We haven't, by the way, this is Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolf, who host the new podcast Primed. Has Seattle charged Amazon for growth the way these other cities are talking about giving them tax breaks? Has Seattle given Amazon tax breaks, or conversely, have we charged them extra because they bring so much with them?
Well, of course, there's been, there's development fees that cities charge for the privilege of developing land. And, Seattle hasn't been embroiled in negotiations with developers of all stripes mm-hmm. about what those could be. And Amazon and its developer have certainly had ideas on the low end of the scale about what they should be paying. There's that. There's also, Growth Management Act does ask developers to deal with some of the impacts of what they build. But historically, over the last 30 years, those things have never worked to truly help pay for all of the consequences of growth. I actually want to know from Tris if she knows of a city that's had some success with impact fees that we might look at.
Well, in my city of Bothell, We have impact fees for traffic, for parks. We instituted a new fire impact fee, and it does contribute to those capacity projects. Like you said, it doesn't contribute 100%. It doesn't cover 100% of costs, but it shouldn't, because new growth isn't creating all of the impact. It's people moving in. It's not the new company that's creating all the impact, and so they don't shoulder all the burden. It's all the other activities that come with it. And no, it doesn't pay for 100%, but it certainly contributes to our ability to build these capital projects that if we didn't have those impact fees, we would be subsidizing that all from the operating fund or not doing the projects at all.
Tris, thanks for your phone call. Carolyn and Joshua, isn't the part of the point of the whole bidding is that these are cities that are not going to charge Amazon impact fees, or is that a bad assumption?
Well, yes, you can imagine that is not something that they are discussing today. Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure.
Let's take another call from Kate in Ballard. We're talking about the pros and cons of Amazon coming to your town. Governor Inslee, by the way, says that Amazon attracted some of the brightest minds from around the world. Maybe that's a great thing about having an innovator like Amazon here. Kate in Ballard, what do you want to say about any downsides to a bidding city? Kate, are you there? Kate and Ballard is hanging back. We'll see if Kate's going to stay with us. John in Queen Anne, what's your advice for a city that would like to be the home of Amazon's HQ2?
For a couple of things. First of all, I would say all those jobs and all those great minds that are attracted, they're probably not going to come from your local area. Amazon's going to come in and cherry pick the best workers out of your existing companies. And then they're going to start bringing in folks from out of town. And it's not going to help things. Those people come in, they bring their politics and their ideas with them, and a lot of your local residents are going to be standing around wondering when their turn is.
They're going to bring their politics and their ideas. Do you mean that's a kind of culture talk we hear about immigration in general? We're going to change. Our city's culture is going to change. Their ideas and their politics are going to come in. John, how do you know when outsiders are bringing in fresh ideas and when a more diverse culture is a better culture?
I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, mm-hmm. but I'm saying if you live in a small, conservative, sleepy kind of place, which, you know, Amazon probably won't end up there, but if you think it's going to still be small and it's going to be the way it was before Amazon came, it's not.
Yeah. Right. Do you have a personal story along those lines, John?
Yeah, I've been here 30 years. When I first got here, Seattle was a working class town with Microsoft kind of, you know, chugging along over on the other side of the lake. Now it's way farther left than it was. And we've got Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, all these folks all over Seattle. So the politics will change. It may be good, it may be bad, but it won't be the same.
Yeah, I mean, we've got 57 people moving here every day. We're only building homes for we're only building 18 new homes every day, too. So there's that. But one of the things that seems to be really affecting people is the pace of the change. It's not that people are opposed to change, but it's how fast it's happening. It's kind of like, you know, if you're traveling on the freeway at 60 miles an hour and a car hits you at 61 miles an hour, it's just a 1 mile an hour impact. So a city that's growing really fast already and has a lot of this change happening already might not feel it as much. But a smaller city, it's kind of like you're standing there on the freeway and you get hit by that same car at 61 miles an hour. It's going to have a much bigger impact on you. And it's the speed at which Seattle has changed that seems to be the most painful for people.
That was good. I've never heard that. And that was excellent.
I'm picturing getting bumped by a car going 1 mile per hour faster than me. That was very useful.
Yes.
Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph host a brand new podcast on KUOW, just launched today, called Primed. And it's basically about what happens when Amazon comes to town. And that's a big subject, an important subject. And that's why it's a brand new podcast. So check out Primed. You can find out about it at KUOW.org. And we're taking your phone calls, your tweets, your advice to prospective bidders. There are cities that think they want to be the home of Amazon's HQ2. What are they in for? What do you want to let them know about? What's fantastic? What is a warning? 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW. Joshua and Carolyn, is there anything in your reporting, this podcast about what happens when Amazon arrives? Did you learn anything that surprised you so far?
Well, do you want to tell that story about going on the radio? I love that story.
Well, I want to hear the story you love.
So I went on the radio in Washington, D.C., and I kept saying to them, well, you need to understand that the jobs are going to come really quickly, and you're going to have some problems. How's your housing supply now? Oh, we have a housing shortage. Well, I'm saying, well, you need to get a hold on that now, before this thing starts up. And they were like, how very interesting. And anyway, on to the tax revenue potential. And I was like, no, come back. Because if you don't take care of this, it doesn't matter so much how much tax revenue you bring in, because it's going to be going out as you're fixing the social problems that erupt because you didn't deal with the housing problem.
Mm-hmm. And then they cut you off and wrapped up the interview?
That's right. Thank you very much. Yes, that's right. It was fascinating. And it reminded me about how when you get that economic development focus, you think of everything as wonderful, but you don't think about individuals, the people.
Democratic State Senator Guy Palumbo called it a sad day for Washington and Seattle when Amazon said they're looking elsewhere, and asked how long after the new headquarters is open until these 40,000 of existing jobs in the state start to move. What a dark day for our economy. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of our listeners probably are looking for any insights you have yet about whether this should we see today's deadline as kind of a dark day for the beginning of the end somehow for Seattle's economy?
Well, they're still hiring here.
Yes.
I mean, they're leasing up land at a break. They're leasing up, new office towers downtown, and they're leasing some office space in Bellevue. And I mean, and they've got like 6,000 vacant jobs listed. So it's not like we're done here.
No, but by the same token, look, we don't know the future of this company. We are used to the idea that things, once they start growing, won't stop. And historically, we know that that's not true. And then in some sort of a reframed Amazon of the future, where there's been some sort of interruption, what happens to us then? I mean, honestly, we don't know. But then again, we never did. We do have the nasty example of our evolving a relationship with Boeing. It used to mm-hmm. live here full time and gave a damn, and now we're just another destination to them.
Just wait till what people will say if Amazon says that their second headquarters is going to be located in Chicago, Illinois.
Ah, Chicago.
That was visceral. So thanks everybody for calling in. Let's pause it here, and I'm going to leave you with one more thought on Amazon from Joshua in Seattle's Central District.
Calling about the Amazon thing, what you might tell other cities, that they're lucky to have such a massively successful company in their town. And I think when you look at the competition, everybody wants that kind of success. And sure, Seattle's changing, but so are a lot of other cities right now. Cities change, and that's natural. And we're blaming a lot of the change that's going on right now on Amazon. And I don't think it's probably fair to pin it all on them. I don't think it's fair to make them pay for the roads. They pay taxes. Why should they pay for extra things beyond that? I think that we're lucky to have them, and I'm sad to see them splitting off and testing other towns.
There's a point of view from Joshua in Seattle Central District who seems to think that any town would be lucky to have what we have. Thank you for your phone calls and your tweets, your questions. And thank you to KUOW reporters Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph. They are the hosts of the new podcast, Primed. So check out Primed. You can find out all about it at KUOW.org. Carolyn, Joshua, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record, and we'll be back in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. So we were just talking about how cities can be remade by an influx of outsiders and change, but are we acknowledging the people who were already here? Listen to this Tlingit artist and storyteller Nahan reading his poem called Indigenous Homeless about how we are avoiding our native people. We recorded Nahan in the U District where his uncle experienced homelessness.
I got a sign that reads, I need change, we need change, and you pretend you can't read. But I ain't talking about just what jingles in your pockets. I'm talking about how your silence is violence, how you just another one of their accomplices, how us indigenous are 7 times more likely to be out here living on the streets than any of you white peeps. I see you walking by every day, avoiding eye contact with me by gazing into your creator screens, bitten apples, Android machines, forgetting about your humanity. The change I need to see is you bringing your spirit back into your body, to use your privilege to actually help somebody. See, they call me homeless, but the whole entire earth is my home, so how can that truly be?
My next guest asks these questions, too. Colleen Echohawk Hayashi is executive director of the Chief Seattle Club that works with Native people who are homeless or low income, and she's a member of the KUOW board. Good to see you again, Colleen.
Good to see you, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, do you have any reaction to that, to the excerpted poem that we just heard from Nahan?
Yeah, well, I'm really grateful for Nahan for sharing it and for his art. And my reaction is that at the core of who we are as a city is a Native city, that we are a city that's named after a great chief of the Suquamish Duwamish descent. And we don't always know and feel that in the city. I think that...
Why is that?
You know, I think that we have an issue where we don't really want to engage in it. We don't really want to remember that that is the fact that there, you know, in 1986, that Native people were banned from even being in with the city limits. The fact that we have so many Native people who are homeless. If you're Native in the city, you're 7 times more likely to be homeless. And I think that's jarring for us as good Seattleites. Like, we believe in the goodness of people and we want to do good for other people, but it's a stark reality that is hard to grasp.
Why do you think that is, that Indigenous people are 7 times more likely to be homeless?
Well, there's a lot of historical factors that have contributed to Native homelessness. We have things like, you know, the reservation systems that moved us away from our traditional homelands. We have systems like boarding schools that moved us out into boarding school systems away from families. And what happened then is that many of our relatives out there who were in the boarding schools, when they got through the boarding school system, they had lost track of their families and they moved into urban centers. And so, in fact, at the Chief Seattle Club where I work, we have folks who never were returned back to their families and just kind of moved into urban centers and became homeless. And then the Urban Relocation Act of 1956, where people were moved out of their reservation systems into cities. And that is when the homeless Native population really became an issue in not just Seattle, but other cities around the country.
And are there solutions that especially work for Native people?
Yes. Great question. I'm glad you asked that, because I truly believe that the way that we are going to see our Native homeless population brought back into housing and into wholeness and wellness is everything to do with trauma, like talking about the trauma, dealing with the generational historical trauma that is a part of the problem and the issue that we have within our Native homeless community. With myself, even my relatives, my staff, we all have experienced this trauma. And so I believe that a big part of seeing us come into wholeness and wellness is to deal with that trauma. And that is going to happen through reconnection with culture and traditional spirituality. So that's part of the work.
How's that going to happen? Who's doing what to acknowledge and deal with this trauma?
Well, I would say it's our Native organizations in this city. We have some incredible Native organizations like the Saddling Health Board, United Indians of All Tribes, Mother Nation, my organization, the Chief Seattle Club, and all 4 of those organizations. We are focused on bringing our people inside, out of the rain, getting them into wonderful, comfortable places where they feel like they can truly be a Native person without any discrimination, without any prejudice, that they're going to be loved and accepted and welcomed in our organizations.
How are they feeling a prejudice now?
Well, I think that just number one, if you look at the data, like we just talked about, we're more likely to be homeless. And you have to think about what has contributed to that. That has been discrimination and prejudice. We saw only 5.5 years ago now, John T. Williams was shot by our police. There is just so many stories that I hear from the folks that I serve at my organization where they feel invisible. They feel like no one is looking at them. No one wants them there.
That's what that poet was talking
exactly.
about in part, invisible.
Yes, exactly.
Why, you mentioned that Seattle is named for a Suquamish, Duwamish chief. Why are we not known for that? I mean, I don't see Chief Sealth on our home, the city's homepage. I don't see. We have totem poles,
right? Yes. Yeah, so totem poles is a problem in my book because totem poles were actually brought back from Alaska Native villages. They were stolen from Alaska Native villages by the gold miners that went up north, and they brought them back, and they were exciting and different, and they became sort of the symbol here in our city that actually does not represent Coast Salish people. I am not a Coast Salish person. I am from the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma and brought in Athabasca in Alaska, but I was always taught as a Native person to remember where we're at right now, and that's Coast Salish territory. And Coast Salish people did not have totem poles. They had welcome poles. They look very different than the totem poles that we have scattered around our city right now.
What does a welcome pole look like?
It's carved differently. I'm not an expert on these poles, but mm-hmm. they look different. You could tell they're different. There's examples of them in different places, like out in Tulalip or Puyallup and Muckleshoot. But we don't, as far as I know, we don't have any actually in our city. They're all appropriated from Alaska Native villages.
Well, I brought up totem poles, but I want to ask you, what is more visibility? What would that look like?
Oh, I think there's so many incredible opportunities that we have as a city. You know, I listened to the Primed podcast this morning, and I was thinking about
this is KUOW's new podcast about Amazon.
Exactly, that you were speaking about earlier mm-hmm. today. And I was thinking about how we are in this opportunity in our city. We've changed a lot, and we are continuing to change. And I think that we have an opportunity for art to really become a new part of our city that really accurately represents the Coast Salish people in this territory. So I think that the other thing that always concerns me, I've been privileged to sit on on the Pioneer Square Preservation Board and work with the different preservation boards. We don't have a preservation board for Coast Salish people or even urban Native people or that culture. Like, what does that mean that we are more excited about preservation of Pioneer Square or the Pike Place Market Historical Preservation Board, but we're not thinking about historical preservation of the Coast Salish people, and not just the preservation of their culture, but of who they are now. It's a thriving culture, and I think we have an opportunity to represent that better.
And you were telling me there's a city that does this, right?
Yeah.
Right up the road, right. Vancouver, B.C. What's the difference?
Well, I think when you go to Vancouver, B.C., it looks and feels more like a Native city. The art is much more prominent. You'll see the different Coast Salish languages of that area more prominently. I think that when I go to Vancouver, which ironically is named after a colonizer or
yes.
an explorer, and we're named after Chief Sealth. When I go to Vancouver, it feels more like a Native space and a Native way. And I think we have a lot to learn from our relatives up north.
And help me with another example of what you mean by Vancouver feels like a Native city.
Well, you see things like the language, I think, you know, that is out there. I know that there's been talk and movement about what would it be like to have the Lushootse language be a little bit more prominent in our city, that we'd have, you know,
that's the language
city.
That Chief Sealth spoke.
Yes, exactly. And to imagine like what it would be like to have, you know, the under Pike Street, for instance, what would the translation be? And how could we incorporate more of that tradition? I think it's only good for us as a city. It's good for business. It's good for tourism. It's just a better way that we could be as a city.
And how does that change life for people? So Canadians, First Nations people, and Indigenous people here, how would that affect you? And I know you're not Coast Salish, but how would that affect people?
Well, You know, the reality is, I don't know. I think it would affect us a little bit. I think that there would be more visibility. I think there would be more interest in addressing the problems that we face as a community. But ultimately, I don't know if it would have it would have an impact, but not as big as we need. What we need is to have people really taking this seriously and asking ourselves, especially within the homeless context, what would it mean to have culturally appropriate services for Native people?
What's culturally appropriate in this case?
Well, I think that it would be something that's welcoming to a Native perspective instead of isolating and ostracizing a Native perspective. You know, we often talk about housing first in our city, about getting our homeless community inside, and I believe in that. I strongly think that is an appropriate response. But at the same time, I think it has to be culturally appropriate. It has to be a place where people feel welcome, where Native people and other people of color feel like, this is a space for me. It's not just a white space, but it's a space where I can feel like I'm welcomed as a Native person.
And what would do that? What would be welcome?
I think there's so many things. I think number one is leadership. I think we need to have more Native perspectives on all the decision-making boards. I think that we also have opportunities to incorporate Native styles of housing, ways of decision-making into our processes.
What's a Native style of housing?
Well, I always say that we've always known how to house our people. You know, we talk a lot about the high performance of our different housing mechanisms in the city. Before colonization, Native people had 100% success rate of performance, and I think that we need to have that opportunity to do that again. And it's something that, as a Native community, we're having to explore and understand because we haven't had that opportunity. And so that's why my organization and other organizations in the city are moving forward towards building our own housing.
Something Canada has done differently is an apology for those crimes that you mentioned. Why is the United States hasn't done the equivalent, has it?
Well, yeah, I think that's been a lot of us who've been involved in this movement for a while have reached out to our president to say, hey, is there an opportunity for an apology to come for all of the atrocity that happened for Native people? When I was in grad school, I was campaigning President Obama. I thought, this is our opportunity. This is the guy who will do it. However, we didn't ever receive any concrete response. And I think the reason for that is that there would have to be payment made to some of our tribes and some of our people because of what they lost. That's what's happened in Canada and Australia.
Reparations.
And reparations, yes.
One thing you're doing, you mentioned you were on the Pioneer Square Preservation Board, which I don't associate with demolishing buildings, but you are demolishing a building in Pioneer Square and making one that will look and feel like a Native building. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, I still have a lot of hurdles to go through, including that Pioneer Square Preservation Board. But what we hope to do in Pioneer Square is offer a space that looks and feels like a Native building. If you go into the building we currently have, the Chief Seattle Club, it feels like a Native space. We have Native art. We have Native people. We've created a gathering circle that is for prayer and for ceremony. And so we hope to extend that in Pioneer Square, right next door to us. We hope to build around 80 to 100 units of housing that would be Native preference so that we could bring Native people into our housing that we have there with the full services of the Chief Seattle Club, which is right next door, which is a human service agency. So we're excited about that opportunity.
The head of the Chief Seattle Club and also a member of the KUOW board is Colleen Echohawk Hayashi. Thanks for talking with us
today.
Thank
you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOWCN. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to The Record. We'd love to hear your thoughts on these conversations. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Our email is record@KUOW.org. Graham Blair is your average college freshman. He's got a great mom, great friends, great future ahead of him. It wasn't always so easy when he started transitioning in more ways than one. Radioactive's Jesse Nguyen has that story.
This is my friend, Graham.
So my room has blue walls.
I don't know. I have a lot of, like, movie
posters.
He's
giving me a tour of his room, like a cool kid.
I have, like, fairy lights up along the ceiling because that's important for my aesthetic.
He just started at Evergreen College this fall.
I'm going to study foreign languages, linguistics, and gender studies.
He's got his bags.
I wanted a new backpack for college.
He's got his books.
I have a bullet journal page dedicated to my aesthetic.
He's got his confidence.
I like to think I'm pretty cute.
He sounds so certain with his life and where he's going, but he hadn't started out that way.
I don't know. It's like, you know how when kids like think they're funny, but they're not? That was me just like all the time. I mean, it's probably still me, to be honest.
Graham has a lot of support going for him, though.
Really, pretty much the instant he was born, I had a full understanding of unconditional love.
That's Graham's mom, Jordan Blair.
She's been supportive the entire time.
That is, being supportive of Graham living as a gay, trans adult.
This whole process, I've been so lucky, and it's not like this for most trans people.
When he first came out to her, though?
He just said, I think I'm trans. And I didn't know anything at all about being transgender. Nothing. And I was surprised and had questions. I did get emotional.
We both cried. I don't know. I also didn't, like, understand anything about the trans community.
Both of them were entering a new world together.
Neither of us knew what to do, but now in retrospect, we're both like, this is, like, the easiest thing.
They navigated everything slowly and even got help on how to best be there for each other.
People talk a lot about, like, how they knew that they were trans, like, from the beginning, and that's great. I didn't. And so it wasn't until, like, eighth grade that I started to question things. But even then, it wasn't, like, an educated questioning. It was, like, looking at WikiHows on how to act like a dude.
But I did suggest that we find somebody that he can talk to that would help him figure it out. Because at that moment, he was wondering if he was.
And so then I got a gender therapist. She's really great. I don't see her anymore because I don't... I mean, everyone needs therapy, but I'm also, like, I don't need therapy.
They worked out the initial bumps in the road once he did come out. Bumps like telling his school and his friends, who all knew him from before he had transitioned, and even telling the rest of his family.
He came out to a group of our friends, our chosen family that we call the Fellowship.
Graham had written an email to the Fellowship to tell them the news, but he hadn't sent it yet.
We were just sitting in the car in the driveway, and he was crying. He never cries, and he was crying and crying, and so worried and saying... What if they're not going to love me anymore? What if they're not going to want to be friends with you? And I just said, it won't matter because they won't be people we want in our lives then. And I just told him, I said, you can't deny the world who you are anymore. And he sent it and everything changed.
The Fellowship had rallied around them to support Graham during this confusing time of his life.
He wouldn't even use the word transgender, didn't like it. It was a very difficult first year.
Because at first I didn't like saying the word, and I would be like, this is a good descriptor of my identity, but I'm not this word, I guess. But now I'm just like, I'm so trans, like the transest you can get.
In fact, Graham was so trans that he decided to have the surgery.
I had top surgery, which is a chest reconstruction surgery.
Once they got approval for the surgery by their insurance company, the hospital only had one slot left, the day before Christmas Eve.
I said yes, and then I called Graham and said, you're having surgery on the 23rd. Merry Christmas.
They were in and out of the hospital within 2 days, celebrating Christmas with the rest of their family and happy with the fact that Graham was another step closer to being more comfortable in his body. Graham's mom was also another step closer to her son. She learned,
it's just not that big of a deal, so everybody should just love their kids.
Physically, Graham was taking a big step towards who he wanted to be and knew that his mom would fight anyone who wouldn't accept him. Still, there was something else in the back of his mind.
Like, a lot of who I was during high school was too uptight and stressed about my grades, but I also didn't have the confidence that I have now.
Graham sought to further transform himself by joining TSB, or the Service Board.
It's a nonprofit youth-led organization that focuses on social justice, service learning, and snowboarding.
And with that, he was thrust into another totally new environment. He began to learn more about the world and about himself.
One of the community agreements at TSB is push your growing edge, which means instead of like going outside of your comfort zone, you just expand your comfort zone.
And he did apply this to his life. That push gave him the confidence he needed to take on the world as an adult going off to college.
I'm turning 19. Oh my God. I mentioned to people that like, I'm an adult, but I don't know how to be an adult.
But that hasn't stopped him from trying. He's got a car, a tattoo, and even a new legal name. Graham had gone down to the King County Courthouse the day after he turned 18. He endured the hours of waiting and nerves piling up in his stomach. And then he was called to stand before the judge.
You know, I had to stand up and be like, no, I'm not doing this to avoid the law, that sort of thing. Then he was like, great, you're done. It was like a 15-second interaction.
But this 15-second interaction opened up so many new doors as Graham transitioned from one chapter to the next. When he enters this new stage of his life, there are new questions to be answered.
Do you want people at college to see you as a trans guy or just a guy?
I mean, if someone asks or if it comes into a conversation, I'll be like, heck yeah, I'm trans. But I'm not necessarily going to be as invested as I have been in high school because I don't want people to think that that's the only aspect that there is about me. And I'm sure people don't think that, but sometimes I think that and I don't want to do that anymore.
From Radioactive, this is Jesse Nguyen signing off.
Okay, is there anything you want to tell each other?
What do you want to tell me, son? How much you love me and think I'm the best mom in the world?
You are okay.
Well, she was leading the witness there. You can find more youth-produced stories on KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media Podcast. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening to The Record. Tomorrow is Friday. Tune in for the Week in Review. We've got the deadline week for Amazon's new HQ. We've got Seahawks getting more political and much more with Zeki Hamid, Kathy Allen, and Rob McKenna. We'll talk to you then.